Welcome, this is Your Call. I'm Hanat Bhava, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. In 1975, after gaining control of large portions of Cambodian territory, the Khmer Rouge troops launched an assault on the capital, Phnom Penh. Led by Pol Pot, the communist movement evacuated Phnom Penh's roughly 2.5 million residents, targeting intellectuals and ethnic minorities, teachers, doctors, and other professionals who were stripped of their titles and forced to toil the countryside and labor in work camps. The Khmer Rouge's social engineering project aimed to create a classless agrarian society. During its four-year reign, between 1.5 to 2 million people died from starvation, execution, disease, or from being overworked. Leader Pol Pot died in 1998 and was never brought to justice. Though in recent years, several Khmer Rouge leaders have faced charges of genocide and crimes against humanity. A new documentary, Days of Justice, follows survivors who travel from the U.S. to Cambodia as they try to share their testimony in a trial in 2014. So today we'll look at the question, what does justice look like after genocide? And joining me to discuss the Khmer Rouge's brutal reign of terror and the journey of the survivors, the journey towards justice, is Days of Justice filmmaker Michael Siv. Michael was 6 years old when he immigrated to San Francisco with his mother as refugees, leaving behind his father and brother in Cambodia. When he was 24, he returned to Cambodia to meet his father and brother. That pilgrimage was documented by filmmaker Spencer Nakasako in the film Refugee. As co-director, Michael's first film, Who I Became. That premiered on PBS in 2003.
Yes.
2003. And Michael joins me in studio. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is a pleasure.
Absolutely.
To be able to talk about this.
Well, Days of Justice is premiering Saturday, March 12th at 3 p.m. as part of CAM Film Festival. That's the Asian American Film Festival. You can find the details at yourcallradio.org. And today we want you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about what happened in the 70s in Cambodia, about the Khmer Rouge regime? Are you or your family members survivors, whether of this genocide or, as we said in the introduction, of other atrocities around the world, whether it's the Nazis in Europe or the Bosnian genocide or the Rwandan genocide or war? What does justice look like to you? And if you're a veteran, what do you remember about this period in history? We are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can also email us with your comments or stories or questions at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Michael, tell me about Cambodia in the 70s. What happened? Just a little background.
From what I hear, you know, most of my knowledge on it is personal. Like my mom tells me the story, or I find it from hear from the community a lot. And
right.
I think it's more personal. It's more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's always been told, like, you know, the Khmer Rouge took over. They just, like, everything became chaos. You know, people were, like, families were separated.
What was before the Khmer Rouge?
It's, you know, like my family, my mom always says that they were happy, you know, everything was looking bright. The future is great, you know. I mean, Cambodia is like one of those kind of fantasy world that never existed in my mind. But my mom always says that it's a, you know, before the Khmer Rouge, it's a home that she will probably never leave, you know. And then all of a sudden, in a blink of an eye, you know, she finds herself with me in a concentration camp. And till this day, I can never have a conversation with her that is clear. Like she doesn't want to talk about it.
She doesn't want to talk about
it. It's too, even after my journey going back to find my father and brother, even that still hurts her. It's I don't know, and I never want to push her because I respect that boundary that, you know, when you hear 2 million people died, when you hear massacre, when you hear babies being smashed on trees and people taken into prison and tortured and to admit to some wrongdoing that you don't even know what it is about. So I don't think it's ever clear, like what the summary that you read or the summary that you stated. I don't think that my mom ever say it that way. It's more like those guys were evil. They separated us. Your dad was in a concentration camp. That's for men. You and I were in for female. I worked my ass off. You are lucky to be alive. That's all I want to talk about. And then that's it. That's all I ever kind of know about the killing fields or what took place based off of that. But then I kind of, so when I became older, I started to kind of, you know, go on the internet or read a book or start talking to some more. And that's what led to my journey of trying to find out more about this history, not necessarily from my mom now, because that's all she can provide for me. So now, based on this film and what I've gone through, I kind of have my own perspective of what took place. And, you know, one is how can I move forward? Because I was young. I mean, I went through it, but I don't clearly remember, but I have vivid memories.
How did you end up here in San Francisco, you and your mother?
My mom tells me, well, I started remembering some stuff when I was in Thailand. So we were refugees there, and then the Philippines I clearly remember because I was older. But before that, it was just vivid memories of bombs and just missiles or just loud sounds. And I still have kind of not bad memories, but it would occasionally happen, like, you know, just something that I think provokes it. And so then my mom tells me it's just, you know, I found my way through the jungles. You know, I had to escape the Khmer Rouge. The Vietnamese took over, and everybody just had this chance to escape. And so then my mom says that, you know, we went to our town to try to find my dad. He wasn't there. My brother wasn't there. And so she says, we have a quick decision to make. You stay there and get caught again, or you just leave. And she paid somebody all the money that she had, or whatever gold or necklace that she had. She gave it to somebody to give us the opportunity to be in a car and drove us to the Thai border. And of course, you have to kind of make through the jungles and all that kind of stuff. But her thing was that she sacrificed everything that she had for me and her to be alive.
And you end up in San Francisco.
Yes. After 3-4 years of refugee camps, we ended up in D.C. first and then San Francisco right after.
Okay. And how did you get into film? So at an early age, right? Like in school?
Yeah. I mean, I was 14 years old.
In the Tenderloin,
I grew up in the TL. Everyone thinks we're like knuckleheads or gangsters or whatever you want to call us. But you know, we're just trying to figure out school, teenage life. And you know, one day I got a job at a youth center, and this guy Spencer Nakasako comes in. He was an artist in resident. All I cared about was playing basketball and making some money and go back out. You know, but he, you know, Spencer came in and he stuck around for like 10 years, you know, throughout whatever time at VYDC, the Vietnamese Youth Development Center. And along the way, I kind of started to get some sort of establish a relationship with him. And when I was in college, he asked me to help him do some sort of a training workshop, you know, get guys off the street, get them...
The knuckleheads.
Yeah, the quote-unquote...
You're talking about...
Yeah, I was coaching basketball. And then he just wanted to try something new with guys that are off the street versus, you know, people that were at school or something like that. He experimented a lot.
Right.
And so one day these guys come in and, you know, they're a bunch of badasses, right? I mean, I know them. They think they're badasses and all that kind of stuff. But then Spencer's route has always been give the kid a camera, take it home, talk to the camera for 5 minutes, talk about anything you want, whatever you want, music, whatever. You know, and I always found it easy. But then these guys, they all took the camera home. They all look at the camera, nothing, silent. They don't have nothing to say.
Really?
So Spencer, of course, he's like, what the hell's wrong with you guys, you know? I mean, so, but he didn't want to push it. So then I said, you know what? I'll take the camera. I'll show them that it's okay to do it. Just because they know me, I'm quote unquote their role model. So I took the camera home. Spencer always made a joke about this. Instead of 5 minutes, I talked an hour and a half.
About what?
And it was about finally, I guess when I was 14 to 24, I never talked about this, which was I found out that my father and brother were alive at the age of 14 years old. My mom always told me when we were in America that they were dead. Mm-hmm. One, I don't know why she said that. At least when I found out, it was just like, wait a minute, they're alive? You told me they were dead. She then says, well,
did she know they were alive?
You know, if you watch Refugee, it's one of those things where what a mom does to protect her son. That's what my conclusion was.
Right.
She knew that if I found out at an early age, it would be overwhelming.
And you would go want to look for them.
Right. And so her thing was sort of
And that's
like,
exactly what you did, actually.
I know. I said, you know what, I'm going to do it now. I'm going to go and look
How
them
did
up.
That decision happen? Going from, I know they're alive, to, I'm going to go to Cambodia.
It's a turning point in my life. I went to school at SF State. I'm almost graduating, but in some point of me is like, wait a minute, there's something that's not clear. I have this question of my father and brother being alive is still hanging over my head. How come I'm just ignoring it? And is that why I'm confused?
Mm-hmm.
Is that why? I mean, I know I am confused because I'm asking these questions all the time. And I finally stepped up and told my mom, I said, I don't care anymore. I understand you might not want to deal with it, but I'm going to do it for myself. You're not going to be involved. So I told her, I promised her that she's not going to be in the film. We respect her boundaries, but this is my journey, not yours. Now, if you want to be a part of it, fine. I mean, those I can talk to her about, but then once we talk about like what actually happened, it's like one or two sentences and it's done.
Mm-hmm.
So then I realized like, you know what? That's all she's going to give me. Now it's my journey to figure out, like, you know, what if I want to find out about my dad and my brother, then I got to figure this out on my own.
And you made the decision not only to make this journey, but to turn it into a film. Why?
You know, I trusted Spencer. I think that he was, like, when I knew him, I was 14. I was just, you know, young and didn't want. You know, it's like there's this wall, right? I don't want people to know that I'm crying over my father and brother. You know, there's other teenagers around. You know, they might laugh at me and all that kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I always kind of kept it to myself. That's the theme that we always tell ourselves is, you know, the silence.
So you went from that to a film that the whole world can see.
Right. Just because I think I was ready. One is I had these questions for many years, and it's bothering me. It's eating me up inside. So, like, you know, I just have to know. And two, Spencer asked, and, you know, at first I was reluctant. I'm like, I don't know if I want to, you know, expose this. But because I had established a relationship with him for almost 10 years, and I knew that he was in the best interest.
Right.
To help me on top of making a film. And I always, and I, like I said, I seen him work with other kids, and he also did Emmy award-winning filmmaker, a.k.a. Don Bonus, which is about a Cambodian refugee in growing up in Sunnydale. And so I saw that film, and, you know, so I figured, you know, he's not going to expose or exploit my story.
Mm.
I think that's the combination is I'm ready. And I trusted the director, Spencer Nakasako.
So you get on the plane. Let me just say, you're listening to Your Call. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And we are talking with Michael Siv. He is director of the film Days of Justice, which follows a group of survivors of the Cambodian genocide from the U.S. back to Cambodia to seek justice. And we will be taking your calls, comments, questions, stories as well, listening to your story about, you know, getting to the border, going through the jungles with your mom. I can't help but think of the Syrian refugee crisis that's happening right now. It's like it's just a different place, but a repeated story, and that many people are living today right. as well. We have many refugees now who are coming to the Bay Area, California. So whether it's that or in Europe, elsewhere, during the Nazi reign over Europe or in Bosnia or in Africa, if you have a story about yourself or your family, we'd love to hear it. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's get back to, okay, so you go back to Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what was that like?
The first thing that when we landed, it was the question was, oh, we're back home. Okay,
what home.
Home meaning, you know, this is embedded in us that we're Cambodian. Even though we grew up in America, everybody's like have this kind of pride of we're Cambodians, right? First thing is a slap in the face, and it's just the airport or the custom looks at us different. Like, you know, guys, bald-headed, earrings. I mean, they just knew. So they gave us kind of a tough time, you know. It's like, yeah, you guys are not really Cambodian, right? And so I think for me, it's like, okay, these locals at the custom are treating me different. I'm terrified of what my father and my brother's going to think of me. One, I can't speak the language that well. And two, it's like before the trip even started, there were all these questions on top of wanting to know my father and my brother, which was there's all these things that happen when war take place or genocide. People separate. You know, I find out from my mom that my brother and father, they don't know each other. 20 years that we were separated, and she tells me that she escaped with me. My father stayed back and looked after my brother, but now they don't know each other for 20 years.
Hmm.
So I'm like, what the hell is going on here? You know? And then he has 9 different kids, so obviously he remarried.
Hmm.
So there was just a lot of things.
To process,
yeah.
Right.
And so that's all I could have. I mean, we stayed in Cambodia. And
did you get to meet them?
Yes. My father and brother?
Yeah.
That's part of the journey was that at the end of the day, was the film was about me and my father.
Right.
There were a lot of decisions that took place during this chaos. And for me, during that moment, I didn't fully understand. I read the books. I understand 2 million people died. I understand the Khmer Rouge wanted to take over and tortured all Cambodians that were during that time. I don't fully understand the details. Like, my father says, hey, I thought you and mom, your mom were dead. I remarried.
Right.
Left it as that.
Mm-hmm.
So then for me, it was like, what do you mean? It can't be that simple. You remarried, but then how come you don't know your own son? It's for his good interest. So he leaves it at that. So then there's
this. So you
this,
have bits and pieces then that you're trying to just put together.
Yeah,
like a puzzle.
Because one is cultural differences. I realize I'm like this American young guy that wants to know. I want to know. On the other hand, he's very traditional Cambodian. It's like, I'm your father. I tell you whatever it is you
need coming to with your entitled American self.
Right. So at least my story between my father and my brother was that trying to figure out how to piece this chaos. Not only the war. The war is a separate issue almost. It's like now it becomes trying to find each other in this 30 years of kind of silence. Nobody talks about it. And I think for me, I'm trying to talk about it, but they don't want to talk, you know.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I think the conflict was between me and my father of he remarried when my mom was alive. But then, so I'm like, wait a minute, so you cheated on my mom. You know, so it becomes like, so he's like, no, I thought your mom was dead. I said, well, but then, so stories and truth and things become clear. Like, so then all of a sudden my brother tells me my mom told him that before she escaped with me, my dad was actually there.
Mm.
He's the one who forced her to leave.
Oh, so you're getting many different messages and
right.
stories.
So the film. Yes.
So how do you process that, and how did that turn into a film? And we're talking about Refugee.
Yeah, Refugee, the movie.
Yeah, we haven't even started about Days of Justice.
Right, Refugee. Right. So I think I want to say I'm a tough guy, but there were certain moments. It's just I'm crying because he's lying to me. I didn't cry on whatever physically crying, but inside it's so hard to try to like accept what he's saying. On one hand, I understand the war. I understand that it 2 million people died, and you do whatever you can to survive. That is the thing that's hanging over all survivors. My mom, my dad. On the other hand, I didn't live through that. I didn't see the torture. I didn't, you know.
There's a disconnect,
right? And so, I try to grab or get a grip on that. But I just need to understand the personal decisions. He decided to stay back. He forced my mom to leave. And so my thing is, of course, I'm protective of my mom. I grew up with her, right? And so I said, you know, so I'm always asking a question to say, well, you know, you force a single a lady with a 3-year-old kid to escape on her own while you stayed back here, say that you're going to look after my brother, and you don't.
But are you grateful to have been here then?
You'd be surprised. In the ending of that film, I said that I would rather stay in Cambodia. As a family, I would rather stay connected together, because the questions that I have, my brother, he's more acceptant because it's the culture, but it's tough. I'm not trying to be greedy or selfish during that moment, but I'm saying, you know, I didn't live through it. Maybe this is why I'm saying this, is that I would rather us stay together, whether it be in Cambodia or in America. So at the end of the day, it's more kind of trying to figure out the solution. And the film really becomes about, do I accept them? No matter, he's always going to say the war is as an excuse. He decided all this stuff because of the war. It's better for my, you know, it's better for me and my mom to leave and for him to stay back. So there's just a lot of stuff going on. But I think in the end, it's more like the message is, you know, all I wanted him to say was, hey, I miss you.
Yeah.
And he, and like I said, he won't even step over that boundary. So it's more than an emotional connection. Like, I think if he just said, hey, I'm sorry for what took place. I'm sorry that I wasn't around. But I'm here. I got other kids to deal with. So he would never cross that kind of a whatever connection that we or relationship.
Right.
And so that end is more like, do I accept him for who he is? And that in the film concluded that, you know, no matter what, he's my dad.
He's your dad. Like yeah. He said, he's your dad.
Yeah.
That is Michael Siv, and he was talking about the film Refugee. He is also director of Days of Justice, which is showing as part of CAMFest, the Asian American Film Festival, about Cambodians who go survivors of the mm-hmm. Cambodian genocide who go back to Cambodia from the U.S. trying to find some justice as part of a trial of some Khmer Rouge leaders. And we're going to talk about that and take your calls about seeking justice after war and genocide. We will be right back with your call.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the telephone, or by sending an email to feedback@yourcall.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. In just a half an hour here on KALW at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll revisit our conversation with journalist Juan Rugrillo about his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. How are narcos affecting civil society and politics across the Americas and the Caribbean? But today we are examining the history of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge regime and the Cambodian genocide. The documentary Days of Justice is showing as part of CAMFest, and it shows March 12th at 3 p.m. as part of the festival. With me is the director of Days of Justice, filmmaker Michael Siv. We've been hearing about his personal story of coming to the U.S. as a refugee with his mother and going back, seeking his father and brother and those relationships and what that all meant. And that was part of a film called Refugee, actually, that features your story. So let's go to Days of Justice now. what was the idea behind Days of Justice? Tell me.
It started out as a very simple journey. It's following, you know, Dr. Lakhna Nu, who worked with genocide survivors in America and helping them find closure to what took place. Mm-hmm. I found out about that story, say, I forgot the year, but it's like maybe 2011. And the one thing about one thing I want to say is that for 30 years, we all kind of live in silence. Nobody wants to talk about this history, including my generation. And all of a sudden, I went to the San Jose event where Lakhna is hosting the survivors and trying to encourage them to speak up. So my initial reaction was, yeah, right. Good luck with that, right? So I'm going in there. I'm like, yeah, they're not gonna go up there and talk or say anything important, right? First, right off the bat, lady goes up and just started to just open up and talked about how she experienced or what she thought about the Khmer Rouge, and it was shocking to me that it not only this woman who lived through the genocide is openly talking about it, but she's talking about it in public, and I was struck by that, and then the information about the trial. There was a case 002. And to tell you the truth, I didn't even know there was a trial in Cambodia during that moment. I knew there was, but I wasn't clear about it until she started to explain that survivors could actually participate.
This is in 2014.
Yes, the case 002 in 2014. That international tribunal has never allowed this to happen, which is the civil parties or people that have gone through the genocide can help prosecute the perpetrators. So
there are remnants of the Khmer Rouge,
right?
That can be prosecuted,
right? So there's four of them, the four top leaders: Nun Chia, Khieu Samphan, Ing Zeri, Ing Taret. I think they were all. I guess the notion was that they're all getting older, and they have to do this for the people that have suffered by their crimes.
Like Pol Pot, who just died, right, 1998, without being.
There was a trial, but it was like locally. It was all people from Cambodia that was, you know, there was some shades of non-justice. It wasn't really justice. It was just trying to put up a front. That's my opinion.
Nothing like the Nuremberg trial.
No.
Okay.
So when he died, so I think that's why the UN and the Cambodian government wanted to do this to give back to help the survivors maybe find closure. At least that's from what I was told. So it started off with that premise. It's just following Lakhna and maybe figuring out or seeing some of the survivors that will be able to go back. Mm-hmm. However, as in the film, there's a turn. So Lakhna tells me one day that, you know, she's thinking of going to Khmer Rouge village in Cambodia.
Up until then, this was all in San Jose.
It was
just like here.
She lives in Long Beach, so I went to Long Beach, followed her around, just like, as documents, just kind of knowing your subjects and establishing a relationship. But then that's what she told me. And when I left Long Beach during that day, I said, "Yeah, right. This woman, you know, she's a professional. She's not going to go back to no Khmer Rouge village." So 2 months later, she says, "I'm going." Are you going to come? So, I mean, I'm not going to lie. At first, I'm like, I don't know if I want to go to the Khmer Rouge village. And to me, I'm still, the notion of Khmer Rouge, evil killers, still in my mind. Even as a filmmaker, I know I have to do it. So, of course, I went.
Can you explain what that means, Khmer Rouge village? It's now?
Khmer Rouge, it's, so when the Vietnamese invaded in 1979, the Khmer Rouge all went and found, like, refuge in Cambodia to as a base. Like, they can, you know, because the Vietnamese government, you know, overpowered them, and I think defeated them. So the Khmer Rouge, they lost. So, but then they found refuge at some places called Samlot, or the northern part of Cambodia is heavy populated Khmer Rouge. And till this day, they are still alive and their children are still kind of there. Now, the children might not understand and might not know just the same thing that I do. You know, we were clueless about what took place. But there's a high population of them still in the northern part of Cambodia. So Lakhana says that we're going there. Now, the turn is, she interviewed, I mean, I want to say that she's very gutsy. That's, you know, for someone that's academic and you know, in that side of the world, to go back to the most remote village where malaria is heavy populated, you know. For me personally, when I was filming, I didn't even want to film just because I thought they were going to do something, take my camera away, or, you know, thinking we're going to exploit them or something like that. You know, mm-hmm. just because I don't think nothing happened, but it's just the fear. I mean, when you hear 2 million people died and stuff like that. But then she's just a rebel. I mean, she's just going. She's like, I don't care. I'm going. So eventually we made it to the mountain. I mean, no local Cambodian would even want to go to this mountain.
So it was you and her and the people who went from here?
No. First, it was just me and her.
Okay.
So as a professor, she wanted to, she thinks that, or she feels like she's already know the survivors. She's worked with them for 3 to 4 or 5 years, and she did her research on them. But then she felt like, well, it's not enough. You can't just understand one side of genocide. You also got to try to understand the others. So that's why it motivated her to try to get to know the Khmer Rouge.
Which is really interesting and hard to, you know.
Right.
We're journalists, right? And we always try to get both sides of the story. But when it's, you know, when it's one group committing genocide against another group, it's hard to say, well, let me hear about, you know, what they have to say. So it's interesting that she made that decision.
Right. I mean, it's interesting personally, but it's also very interesting in a cinematic point of view, because now, okay, the survivor story is the backbone, but then if you can add the element of this side, you know, and who knows what she's going to be able to get. I didn't feel like we're going to get anybody big, for example, like, you know, Nunchi or whoever was on, because they're arrested already. They're ready for a trial.
But so, you'll get loyalists.
Right. So eventually she went, and the turn of the film is she found the son of one of our most hated killers. And he's really involved in the film. I don't want to give up too much, because mm-hmm. that's actually the turning point of the film, mm-hmm. is that he, somehow she invited him to come to the trial. First he looked at us and he taunted us, like, hey, 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 yeah, whatever, I'm not going to. But I don't know what happened. I can't give it away. But he decided to come. And now, so you got three genocide survivors from America who out of 750 that applied and got accepted. So going back on it, 750 got accepted from Lakhana's or Dr. Nu's client or testimony, but only three decided to go. So those three, it took a lot of courage for them to say, okay, I'm going to go back, I'm going to face these guys who killed my family, who killed my children. I'm going to help the Cambodian government prosecute. So even to make that journey, just to say I'm willing to do it. I respect that full wholeheartedly, because even my mom would not even like want to go there. So these women, to me, was just, you know.
And I can imagine this going across cultures and across communities, like we were talking earlier, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of a place like Rwanda or Darfur, just like making that you are now safe in, you know, America or Canada, wherever you are. And someone comes to you and says, let's go back to your village mm-hmm. in Darfur. Let's go back to that Bosnian village you were in and, you know, get justice. It's hard.
Right. Yeah.
That's a hard decision to make.
Like, you know, so... Of course, you know, so we try to get to know the survivors, personally, for me at least, mm-hmm. and for the film, is the first woman that I really got to know was Om Sopani, or Sopani Bay, but I call her almost like auntie in Cambodian, so respect. Her story is just, like, that's the first person I kind of talked to personally, and it is just, it's like, I know my personal story, and it's, you know, sad, it's messed up, but I can't help to feel the compassion or passion for her stories, that she's like my mom. She was single. I mean, her husband was in the army, and they shipped him for military training in America. So when the war happened, he could never go back. So he was stuck in America. So she had three kids, all a 6 months, a 2 year old, and a 4 year old. And when the war happened, she had to escape with them or try to escape with them. Mm. All died. Mm. One of them she had to watch while the Khmer Rouge were experimenting or executing or, you know, torturing the baby, a 6-month-old. And so...
This is Om Sopani.
Om Sopani. Mm-hmm. And she's telling me this while we're... You know, my style is... I'm on the fly. I don't sit her down and just talk. So I ask her questions when we're at the airport or whatever. It's just to kind of get the cinematic verite style, right? And so she's telling me all this stuff while we're traveling to Cambodia, sitting in a restaurant eating. And this woman is so, like, she did not shed one tear when she's telling me this. That tells me, at least, she has thought about this, or she has probably cried over this many times, that now her focus, I'm going to get these guys, I'm going to do whatever it takes to find justice.
Right.
So
and then they're sitting, so Om Sopani and the other two are sitting across from the son of one of the, you know,
killers.
Biggest perpetrators of this violence.
Actually, he's the son of Dutch. Dutch is the first Khmer Rouge to be convicted. Mm. He was in the first case, 001. So when the UN and the Cambodian government agreed, they put Dutch first because he's the quote-unquote high-profile whatever. He's not the biggest. He's not the most high-ranked like these four. But he, because of his facility, it's called Toh Slang. It's a prison in Phnom Penh. So it's the capital. I mean, there's torture chambers all over Cambodia, but everybody knows of Phnom Penh. Mm. And his father ran that, and he was responsible for 20,000 deaths.
And here he is on one side, and Om Sopani and...
The survivors.
The survivors are on the other side. What happens when they meet?
Silence. It's a... It took Lakana to mediate, like, to, you know, like... It's like they don't say anything to each other about, hey, your father. They don't ask questions. Hey, is your father this? Or he doesn't say, hey, you guys want to find justice? Nothing like that. It's really getting to know each other through this journey, this trip, going to the trial, eating lunch with each other. I mean, this is not in the film, but my cameraman was American. He's white, Caucasian. And he kept looking at me. He goes, hey, Mike, is this normal? I said, what do you mean? I mean, son of a killer. I mean, so my thing was like, it's a natural thing. I said, yeah, well, they're human beings. I mean, I'm not going to force it. Mm. I'm not going to say, hey, what do you think about his father? Or, hey, Pang, what do you think about the survivors? You know, I kind of just let it be. And because
at the end, were able to sit and like have meals with him, you said?
Yeah, I mean,
space with him at least.
In the beginning, it was rough.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's a scene in the van before we go to the killing fields where his father, you know, took people from the prison to dump dead bodies. So it's a mass gravesite, and we're going there. And so this song comes up. It's not on the radio, but one of the Om Sarim, who's I call it again Om
auntie.
Yes, Sarim Nu. She sings a song, right? And it's a wedding song, but it's a reflection of what the Khmer Rouge did, you know. So it's like kind of taking a little stab at him, mm-hmm. and he sits there silent, Like, he doesn't smile, he doesn't react, but they're singing it, the survivors, and they're laughing about it, right? So,
but he stays. He's just there.
Oh yeah, he's. And then they ask, like, so what do you think about the song? You know, and then he responds very kind of, you know, stoic, no reaction. And,
yeah.
And he actually says, you know, I thank you guys for allowing me to come, even though I'm, you know, you hesitate. I'm
a what?
Son of Genghis Il, you know, the one who was responsible. So there's an embarrassment that's taking place here, right? So for me, that's very interesting, right? Like,
And what did that make them feel? Like, what do they say that does for them to see this person embarrassed before them?
You know, I think during that time, they didn't... I think the good thing was that they didn't care he was there or not, because they know at the end... they're not, like, naive. They know that he's only the son, that he did not kill anybody. They know that he's probably guilty or feeling a lot of guilt or whatever it is because of his father. Their thing on the agenda was finding justice at the court and hearing the Khmer Rouge who were responsible. So they put him on the side. Like, they just said, you know what? This is Lakhana.
This is not about you.
This is Dr. Lakhana's research or journey. This is not ours. We're going to respect that. But I think Lakhana kind of just, you know, in her own way, she never really forced anything. She's just kind of let it be. You know, if there's something that happens that she needs to be the mediator or something like that, she'll chime in. But most of the time, it's like kind of a good setting where, for film at least, you just let people be.
Mm-hmm.
Om Sapani, I think she probably had the most difficult time with him. I think she didn't want him to be around. She thought, like, you know, if he's around, Cambodia is, I mean, I don't want to say it's whatever, but if they found out that he was the son of Genghis Il, there would have been a lot at stake. Like some stuff would have happened, right? And so Om Sapani was like, I don't want him around almost, right? So there's
they would have been at risk.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think so the other two were very, they didn't say anything, but I think Om Sapani was the most spoken about it.
And so what happens at the trial?
Nothing. The trial, nothing happened. And I'm saying this from not the filmmaker yet. I'm saying this as somebody who lived through this genocide. That
right.
There's, it's almost to me, it's important for the survivors, but nothing came out in terms of what the Khmer Rouge said, because they all denied. They all said that, you know, somebody else told them to do it, the higher rank. So if you want to blame me, blame whoever is my superior.
Who's dead,
right? So that's the, I have a feeling I felt like it was staged. I felt like, you know, whoever told him, like, you know, this is what you say, this you'll be, you know, the lawyers, they have lawyers. So,
oh, there you go.
Everything is, but I do feel like it's important to have it. I feel like the survivors, even though it's unclear what justice is, but it was important for them to be there, to see that even though it's staged, to see that even though these guys said, like, yeah, you know, I'm tired, I can't talk anymore, let me get some rest. That was part of the spiel. It was like, you know, I'm tired, let me get some rest, I'm tired. They'll talk about 5-10 minutes and I'm
the
tired.
The accused?
Yes. So I think if you think that justice is going to be found at the court with that kind of a environment, I'm laughing. Inside, I mean, I'm not laughing in front of anybody. I'm just, it's almost like it's not going to happen. So that's why I really struggle with the title of the film. At first, I call it Wounds We Carry.
Wounds We Carry. Mm-hmm.
So because I always thought it was about, you know, our wounds, right? I mean, to try to heal and all that kind of stuff, right? But then I thought about more and more. I look at it and just, like, you know, this word justice. It's, you know, at least for us during that moment with Pang, the son of a killer. Paying his name, being there with the survivors, with Lakhana, you know, we're traveling to different parts of Cambodia. Khmer Rouge are saying, you know, repetitive, not useless stuff. You know, it gets more confusing. You know, it's not as clear as,
especially that this was so long ago. I think
right,
like 30 years ago.
Right,
they're able to kind of, you know, not be clear about things.
Right, they're hiding behind stuff. You know, and I mean, at the end of the day. What also is like, well, why are we depending on these guys for closure or justice? They're the one who started all this. They're the one who caused the silence and the pain and the hurt. Now we're going to still allow them to control this, right? So I'm not saying in the film I didn't do anything to challenge that. Mm-hmm. But during the post-production and during the creative end, it's like, how can we not just allow... And plus, for me, growing up, I'm always kind of tired of, you know, when people talk about the Cambodia or what happened, it's always about the Khmer Rouge. Mm. Why are they getting so much attention? I don't get it. They cause all this stuff, and we still... Every film that I've seen, it's like 90% of them always... Oh, Khmer Rouge, Khmer Rouge, Khmer Rouge. It's like, why? Who the hell are we? What's my story? Where's Lakhna's story? Where's the survivor's story? You know, it's not... I mean, yeah, we can talk a little bit about the Khmer Rouge. We can touch on it. But nobody gives a... Almost nobody cares about our story.
You feel it defines Cambodia.
Yes. They have taken it over. They have destroyed it. They have taken it over. And then now it's all about... It's like they bookmarked their imprint.
All right. That is Michael Siv. The film is Days of Justice, showing as part of Cam Fest. We are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK if you have a question for Michael or if you have a story that you'd like to share. Let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Now, listen, Michael, there's a principle that we've been attempting to establish for some time now, since 1945, which we refer to as the Nuremberg Principle, that if you take an order from someone who's obviously issuing an illegal order, an order which contradicts the principles that were set down at Nuremberg, for instance, if you take that order and then harm comes to people as a result, that there is no defense in saying, I took an order. Your responsibility is to refuse to take an order.
Right.
Now, what happened to that principle in this situation?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the call. Wow. Michael?
I think Dutch, the first trial, he used that as his defense. Like, he took order from, I think he has superiors with Nguyen Chia, who's on trial right now. He lost. They gave him life in prison. And I think that you're right. No matter what, the guy, Nguyen Chia might have given, or whoever it was gave Dutch the order, Nguyen Chia looked at the paper and he ordered that execution. So the superior told him, but he didn't have to do it. But Pang tells me, when I talk to Pang, you know, during interviews, that his father had to do it. If he didn't do it, his father would have been killed, and so was his family. So that's his defense. It's like, I mean, and when you hear that kind of stuff, because what I'm saying too is, it's not as simple as what people make this to be. What I learned about this film is that, especially hanging out with Pang, there's this other side that we have not heard. We always talk about the Khmer Rouge like his father or Nguyen Chia. His story has never been told. My story has never really been focused. And I'm more interested in focusing on those. Like, he's struggling to try to understand what his father really did.
Right.
His father told him what he wants to tell him. Pang knows that, yeah, you're my father, I believe you, but you did kill those guys, right? But then how can you admit that to somebody? How can he say that? You know, I feel bad that my dad killed. But you watch this film, Pang really grew. He learned, of all the characters in the film, he probably, in my opinion, got the most out of it.
And that's a chance he took.
He was
like
brave.
Kind of going against his own people as well.
He is brave. Trust me. When you watch this film... And what he does or what he attempts to try to do and stuff, it is. For me, I'm not, you know, in love with Khmer Rouge or whatever it is, but I admire his courage and what he's trying to do to you know, find who he is, which is similar to who I am, right? And so I think that's the thing about this film, is it's not just about the survivors. You know, it's not, it is, but it's not. The message of the film is also, you know, who we are, second generation, and that we're affected by this as well, and our families.
This is probably my last question to you, but has your mother seen the film, and what does she think?
She has not seen the film. She will be there, probably with the survivors.
On Saturday?
On Saturday, at March 12th at 3 p.m. She is probably the most difficult person to
present this to.
To imagine what she's going to think.
Uh-huh.
She's not in the film. She's probably in it in the beginning with photos only just to establish my character and as a narrator. But she's not in the film.
But she's the one who doesn't want to talk about it,
right.
Any of this.
And she's the one who always tells me, don't talk about that. Don't do whatever you do with the film, don't touch the Khmer Rouge. They're going to kill you. Okay, that's been what she told me now. And she knows I'm doing it.
Mm.
And she's always kind of like laughing at me, like, well, I told you, or scolding me. Not laughing, but scolding me.
Right.
Why do you do that? I told you not to do that. So now she's like, okay, well, since you're done, I'm going to go. She's coming. Like I said, I'm just interested to see what she's going to say after. Knowing her, she won't fully say what she feels or think. That's just in her nature. But
you can tell.
Yeah, it's by her reaction and her interaction later on with either me or the survivor and stuff like that. So it's a special moment, I think. You know, it's not just for my mom. I think the survivor's going to be there. Most of the community that from San Francisco will probably, you know, be there. So I think it's going to be, for me, I feel like it's not...
And Professor New?
Oh, yeah, she's going to be there, of course. Professor New is always going to... Yeah, she's a big part of what the film, how the film has kind of gotten to this point.
All right.
And completed.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and being here today with us. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. This is... going to be a great show there, everybody. Thank you.
Oh, well, the film Days of Justice, Saturday, March 12th at 3 p.m. is a part of CAMFest, the Asian American Film Festival. You can go to klw.org or yourcallradio.org and find all of this information about the film. Thank you again, Michael Siv, the director, for joining us. I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This has been Your Call. See you next time. On the next Your Call, we'll revisit our conversation with journalist Yoann Griot about his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Since the Cold War ended, Griot says drug gangs have grown into cartels, wielding violence and enough power to strong-arm governments and command militias. So how are narcos affecting civil society and politics across the Americas and the Caribbean? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.